and also a member of the Festival Ideas Board. One of the many pleasurable things that that entails is introducing some of the really outstanding speakers that come to Bristol as part of the Festival Ideas programme. So it's an honour this evening to be introducing this event with Danny Dorling. I'm sure that most of you here are familiar with his work, but let me just very briefly introduce him. He is Professor of Human Geography at the University of Sheffield. He was briefly for about 4 years in the Geography Department here at Bristol in the 1990s. I'm a loss that he's no longer with us, but it's great that he's returned to Bristol to speak to us this evening. He has many achievements, including, if you haven't visited it, I would recommend that you look at the website worldmapper.org, which he developed with colleagues, which is a fantastic resource for showing who has most and who has least across the world. He's a member of the World Health Organization Scientific Resource Group on Health Equity Analysis and Research. He's a patron of the charity Road Peace and an academician of the Academy of Social Sciences. His books include Injustice, Why Social Inequality Persists, and that was commended for our own Book of Ideas Prize here at Bristol in 2011. So You Think You Know About Britain, and Bankrupt Britain, An Atlas of Social Change. If you want to know any more of these publications, do visit Danny's own website, where you can get a fantastic insight into all his range of publications. He's going to be speaking to us this evening about his most recent book, which is published by Policy Press, called Unequal Health, The Scandal of Our Times, in which Danny explores the current extent of inequalities in health and explains why he perceives this to be particularly scandalous. We will, after Danny's spoken, have an opportunity for questions and discussion, and then there will be an opportunity to purchase the book, which is heavily discounted this evening as a special offer, Danny will be available to sign books in the bookshop afterwards. I would encourage you, if you enjoy this event, to look at the Festival Ideas website, where you can see a whole range of other events which are taking place in the coming month and throughout the year. This website address just here, and you can sign up then at that address to get regular email updates about other events coming up. I might remind you about that later on. But let me now, with any more ado, introduce you to Danny Dorling.
Thank you very much for coming. I'm going to speak for about 30 minutes because what I'm most interested in is what you think about what I've got to say, what the book has to say, where you think I may be going wrong, or where you may, hopefully in some cases, agree with me. One person who does agree with me today is the Secretary of State for Health, Jeremy Hunt, who's quoted as saying that the health performance in Britain is shocking compared to other countries. I'm going to be talking about two shocking things today. One is that health performance and why it might be as it is. And secondly, I think the shocking thing about Jeremy Hunt being Secretary of State for Health and what the government are currently doing, what they've done, how fast they have done it, and where we're going if we carry on in the direction we are. And I'm also going to talk a bit about where we've come from, so the reason for the picture of the pub is to remind me I'm talking a bit about the past as well. I should say, somebody's mentioned Twitter. If any of you have got any of those electronic devices with you, Ben Hennig, who I work with, has very kindly made a website for the book. So if you Google Unequal Health now, you should be able to find it. And I know he's monitoring hits, so I wanted to make him feel happy. So just a couple of hits would make Ben happy. Yeah. Okay, the other thing I'm going to try and do, and I may fail, but if you think I'm being a bit flippant, you'll know why, is I'm going to try and not make this too depressing, because it easily can be very depressing to talk about health inequalities, government cuts, and so on. So I may fail at that, but I will try to do that. So we have a few little competitions. This is the first little competition. You have to try to work out who the pixelated person there is. Shout out if you're very quick. Take it a bit further. See it in your brain already. makes seem a long time ago, the election campaign. This is actually, I'll show you in a minute the poster that there actually was produced, or the fake poster that they produced then. This came shortly after the election, when it came clear what was really going to happen. For the book, I should say the book, by the way, is a large part of it is edited work for other people's work. I think George W. Smith is here, Mary Shaw is here, and it should really say edited by me. But about 30,000 words the book are new, and that gives me a chance to try to avoid libel, but say what I think of what's been going on. The book was written over the course of 2012, when things were changing so much. And at the beginning we had the Health and Social Care Act, and then we saw what was really occurring. The amazing thing about what I think it's fair to call the privatisation of the NHS were the number of Conservative members of the House of Lords who never normally bothered to vote on anything, who could be persuaded to come in and vote this Act through, and who it later turned out were on the boards or otherwise connected with private healthcare companies and were personally going to profit from the cutting up and selling into little bits that may be going on. This is what the actual viral poster was at the time. So people were not so prescient to realise exactly what's going to happen, but it turns out that we are seeing something which is currently quite remarkable. In the last week, you'll have seen, I think it's Felicity Lawrence reporting the inquest of the baby who died at the hands of the lack of attention given by the doctor, paid by, I think it's Harmona, I've forgotten. I haven't yet learned the names of all the private healthcare companies that come into Britain. I'm an optimist, so I hope I don't have to learn them, because I hope we can find a way of getting them out of healthcare in the short term before we all have to know who our private provider is for ourselves. Before you think I'm going to be too mean on any one political party, the scandal of health inequalities is really a scandal that goes across all the main political parties. When Labour came to power in 1997, their new Secretary of State for Health, Frank Dobson, said that inequalities in health were the worst inequalities of all, the thing that matters most to you, and the thing that the party was most determined to reduce, having come into office. Airbrushing in 1997 was less rare. I can't remember when Photoshop came in, but apparently it's actually quite threatening. But if you look at the record, this is the gap between the best and worst off constituency in terms of life expectancy for women in this case. And you'll see that shortly after abandoning certain spending plans, the gap begins to rise and rise relentlessly. And you could be cynical and say, it was part of Britain that deserved better. By far the biggest increase in life expectancy and in wealth and in things like, at the beginning at least, educational attainment occurred in the richer parts of the country, the parts that hadn't voted for Tony Blair in office. They saw the biggest improvements, and so the gap grew. And what this tells us, I think more than anything, is that it's a difficult problem. There aren't easy solutions to reducing inequalities in health. Just to be fair to the Liberals, here's our Nick, my local MP at the moment, much cherished in Sheffield. The reason for putting up the table next to Nick is that Nick was extremely fond of quoting from tables like this before 2010 about how the inequalities that we now saw between the worst and best of areas were larger. This is just before the election, were larger than we saw in the 1920s and 1930s. And he's gone remarkably quiet since becoming Deputy Prime Minister on quoting these things. If I've got a main message to tell you today, it's about the current complexity of the arguments about what is going on with health inequality. I'm going to try and link health services to health inequalities in one way. This statue stands right next to the Park Hill flats in Sheffield. You can see it from much of the city. The Park Hill flats are the ones made famous at the beginning of the Full Monty. They're now Grade 2 listed. They're Council flats. People know about the Park Hill flats. Even in Sheffield, they don't know what this monument is. This is a cholera monument, the people who died of cholera just over 150 years ago. And what I want to try and do in my remaining slightly shorter 20 minutes is try and make a connection between public health and the attention given to cholera back then and what we don't yet know or are not sure about health inequalities now. In Oxford, there was a doctor called Henry Ackland who looked at a whole series of theories about what it might be that was causing cholera and came to one conclusion that it was when you got, I think it was thunder without lightning, this could be causing cholera. And it might seem to you completely ridiculous, but if you try to put yourself back to thinking what could be causing this relatively new disease, what could it be? You look for all kinds of connections to try to find a correlation. And that was one which was taken by at least one person seriously. I'm going to speed up for the slides a bit now. Geographers like me like cholera because of the maps. Because it was actually in Germany that the maps began. But one thing that did begin with cholera is the crossing of the case that this is in Leeds and here's one in Wellington, to try to work out just how clustered it was and was it related to other things. I got into health inequalities by coming to work in Bristol and meeting people here who were interested in them. And I began to think I was a bit cursed when I began looking at this, because I lived on Richmond Terrace for a time, in that block of flats just there, which was the centre of a typhoid epidemic. I'll let you read that if you want. Where I went to work in Leeds later on was the centre of a cholera epidemic, and where I grew up in Oxford was the centre. Eventually, you just work out there have been epidemics everywhere, of course. Many decent density of population is what you need. But William Budd, who did a lot for this city, it's amazing people remember the slaving families but don't remember William Budd as much in the water. William Budd's quote there, that he was never yet connected with his poorer neighbour by deeds of charity or love, may one day find when it is too late that he is connected with him by a bond which may bring them both at once to a common grave, I think is still applicable today. When Jeremy Hunt says it's terrible that our health is so much worse than the health of people in other affluent countries, it's not just the health of the poor, it's also the health of the rich in Britain. And the reasons may well be because of a lack of connection between the rich and the poor. It's just much more complicated in a way now than infectious diseases, at least are now in terms of what we know about them. Just a couple more maps. This is Gateshead. If you're ever on the main East Coast main line going up to Scotland, just look down as you go over the time to see where the clusters of cholera cases were there. And this is the famous cluster in Soho. And that's kind of history of worrying about a past problem that we've kind of forgotten about. We've forgotten about it so much that we can now joke about it. This cartoon was etched in chalk at Piccadilly Railway Station at Manchester, because we now take sewers for granted and their existence for granted. And what I hope might happen is that in 150 years' time, we'll have the modern equivalent of Banksy drawing some kind of cartoon joking about the wealth and income inequalities that we put up with now, if that's what really matters for the scandal of our time. This graphic's fairly new, it's produced in 2012, and on the side it's showing life expectancy, and down here it's showing wealth inequality. And these graphs are normally drawn with income inequality, because it's harder to get wealth data. But I'm putting it up, partly because I know some people in the audience are involved in these debates, to others of you, you're thinking, why is it getting so technical? I'm putting it up just because the box gets straighter once you look at wealth rather than income. And in particular, if you're thinking nerdy, I'll talk to you about Denmark in a minute. The Danes have always been causing us a problem when it comes to this, because Denmark, if you know it, appears to be an incredibly happy, liberal country with relatively low income inequality. So how could people in Denmark are dying? It's almost the same thing. USA in terms of life expectancy. And we thought it was because they smoked, but then the question is, why did the Danes smoke, or why did older Danes smoke as much? But this gets me back to the thunder without lightning problem. We're at a stage looking at the causes of unequal health, which I think is similar to that stage of Conway. We're not sure. We're producing lots of correlations like this, and we get more excited as the correlations get tighter to each other. I have this graph in the book, so I just want to put it up. These are the five relatively poor countries in the world for which we get good data on the richest 1%. It's partly chance that they line up so nicely. But essentially, the more 1% get, the lower the life expectancy. China's a much more efficient country than India. South Africa's awful. There are things like AIDS and what's more going on. It's very complicated. But it's just interesting to see that. Here's the equivalent graph for the richer countries in the world. Not quite as neat a correlation. And there's Denmark, that place which has been upsetting people. You know, very equal, but why are they living so long? But this is income inequality, not wealth. So I'm trying to give you a sense of the sort of staggering around that's going on at the moment, trying to disentangle what it might be that relates life expectancy and other forms of indicators of health with how we're living our lives. Bills and Boone. This is a story about doctors. So I want to give you a story about doctors. I've forgotten what I typed in to try to find out something about where doctors were and ended up with. I think it's Posh Doc. That was it. I typed Posh Doc in to Google and got Posh Doc Society Wedding and realised there's an entire genre of Milton Boone's books simply based on doctors. There tragically isn't one on geographers at all. But the reason I typed in Posh Doc was, this is a bit of a messy graph, but it's looking at where doctors, people who are clinically qualified but not actually working as doctors, live, as opposed to where there are people who are ill and have health needs. And the graph's a bit messy to make the argument, but it goes in the right direction, and it's even better with doctors in work. Doctors don't like living in or really anywhere near places where quite a lot of people are ill. And the main reason for this is because doctors tended to have come from a background which was posher. They certainly joined one which is posher, even if they didn't come from one. And so the idea that suddenly you're going to go and live in the Welsh Valleys, for instance, can be hard to persuade. Now, this is much less of a problem in more equal countries, which is most of the OECD. In more equal countries, you don't have areas that are so poor or areas that are so rich, and it's far easier to get your doctors to live near to the population at large. You don't try and move away from the poor. And this is NHS doctors. It's even worse for private doctors. It's worse for dentists, who would much rather, I won't get myself into trouble about dentists, there are lots of very nice dentists, but of course there's a group of dentists who would rather whiten teeth than reduce pain. And it must be. I mean, who can I at all? A job where you're dealing with people who are ill every day, you can see why people might move away from it. But it's easier to do that in a country that's more unequal. What I'm trying to get at is that there are lots of reasons why inequality can make our health problems bigger, other than some of the reasons that have been put forward traditionally. Including, if you think doctors do anything that's good for our health, the fact it moves our doctors away from people who have the worst health. The most unequal country in the rich world by income is Singapore. I love this picture. It may just be me, but this is a picture of a family in Singapore looking at the survivor list of the Titanic. The family are looking in 2012 at the list from 1912. 1912 was the peak of inequality in income in Britain. We've never been more unequal than that, and we became progressively more equal after 1912. And the list of who died in the Titanic, just how even the upper class men managed to get off faster than some of the children in the steerage class, was kind of epitomised the problems of an unequal society then. What I think is remarkable about this picture is that that family in Singapore almost certainly don't know that they're living in the only rich country in the world that has managed to get back levels of inequality that Britain had in 1912. And there's a whole question about where, in general, we're heading. You're beginning to get quite a lot more antagonism about this in this country. It's happening at a rate which I think means that we accept it slowly, and we can often think that not much is changing, because we forget that the Director General of the BBC is now paid a lot less than the one who's gone off to New York. We're still annoyed by Stephen Hester's salary, even though it's less than his predecessors, and so on. But you're beginning to get a change in Britain in attitudes to income and wealth, which is similar to what we had over 100 years ago. The point of making this in relation to health is that, geographically at least, between areas, the gaps between areas in terms of life expectancy fell from the 1920s to the 30s, to the 40s, to the 50s, to the 60s, to the 70s. And the same thing occurred with the gaps in income, and it slightly lagged the gaps in wealth. As we become more equal financially, we become more equal in terms of how long we tend to live. Let me get back to the lovely Conservative Party. This is Andrew Lansley. Possibly, I make a claim in the book of the most despised Secretary of State for Health ever. I'd be interested if any of you have any suggestions of somebody who'll be more despised. He was sacked by Cameron, even. This picture with the happy nurses, I think, was taken seconds before the consultant burst in the room and said, "What the hell are you doing here?" It's just interesting, I think, the effects of authority on people. Maybe all those nurses really do like Mr. Cameron. Or maybe it's nice that you have your day broken up or something different occurs. Nurses, by the way, are the only group of healthcare professionals who are more likely to live in poorer areas. And because the NHS tries to move money to poorer areas, you end up with a lot of nurses serving the population in poorer areas because it's hard to get the docs to move there. You might be thinking, why does all this matter so much? It's a kind of skirmish in a rich country, but we've never had it so good, in a sense. This is a map, you mentioned world map at the beginning. This is a map of the world shaped where countries are drawn in proportion to children who die between the ages of 1 and 4. Between 1 and 4, almost every death is avoidable. Drew this map over 10 years ago, or the data comes from over 10 years ago. It's a shocking map to look at. But the good news about this map is that there's been an incredible reduction in the number of deaths that's occurred worldwide to children between ages 1 and 4, and infant mortality recently. Now, I'll leave this on for a minute so that you can see it, but partly because I don't want to make this all depressing for you. Last year, we got for the first time data which suggested that the biggest ever relative drop, could be absolute drop actually, the biggest ever drop in infant mortality to occur worldwide has just occurred. I think this is possibly the best news story you can produce. If you think of the absolute reduction in the numbers of grieving parents worldwide that's occurred because of this drop in infant mortality, the drop in infant mortality partly occurred because fewer people are having children, so fewer people are having children on the margin. But there are lots of very good news stories out there. The worldwide pattern looks a bit like, and I know these things don't copy art, but it looks a bit like the achievements that were made in rich countries 80 or 90 years ago, when we were becoming more equal, when we were seeing dramatic drops. The 1940s and early 1950s were a period of particular improvement. So worldwide there's some very good news going on. But what worries me is that this could change into that picture of growing inequality, depending on what happens, what kind of models people accept. I'm going to jump again, because one thing worth pointing out, or to say it's complicated, is that you've got to consider many things. We've had an increase in the last year in the number of people dying on the roads. It's one of the major killers of children and young adults. If you have a look at there, the breakdown of causes of 17, 18 and 19 year olds. And so if you think that inequalities in income and wealth are one of the things which underlie inequalities in poor health and mortality, you've got to kind of link things like how we behave on the roads and so on to those things, and they don't always match on perfectly. Congestion is a brilliant way to reduce mortality on the roads, getting the speeds down to under 30. I'll give you one more fact, which isn't in the book because it only came out very recently. It's not just that the absolute number of deaths on the roads has gone up in the last year. The total number of deaths in Britain has had its biggest rise in over a dozen years last year. The data's only just come out, so this is up to January 2013. And it's mainly amongst the elderly, people in their 80s and a few in their 90s have had a big rise in mortality. The thinking I've seen from the Department of Health is partly that there was a baby boom in 1919 after the First World War, but that isn't enough to explain it. My best guess, if you think about the care home scandals and people worried about that the home they're living in was going to go bust and they were going to move, all Meals on Wheels becoming more precarious and all these kind of things, I suspect in a few months, maybe a couple of years' time, we may link to this biggest rise in mortality that's occurred for 12 years without a cold winter, that's the key thing, to increasing fear among some people who are elderly, affecting them in some way to make them less likely to make it through the year. So all different kinds of things we're looking at. So more positive things. There's a very tenuous link to this map. This map does appear elsewhere in the book. The link is to Obama. And the reasons why you could be positive about what's happening worldwide. And also to the outgoing president of China today. Obama, in his inaugural address for his second term, put as one of his two main commitments the reduction of inequality in the United States of America. And the outgoing premier in China, along with corruption and reducing it, put inequality and reducing it as one of the main aims, or what should be one of the main aims of the next regime in China. And I think these things are positive. There are lots of positive things going on in the world, just not in Britain right now with what's happening with health and health service. I have to say, I wanted to put this picture into a book for ages, and so I found a reason to put it in. But it's a picture about how we see ourselves and how we see others and how self-obsessed we can be. It's your body, well, if you're male, it's your body drawn supposedly in proportion to your nerve endings. And if you ever worry about it, also shows you the amount of disagreement that there is out there about which parts of the body men think about the most. Whenever people produce opinion poll surveys, I think these things are very funny because most of us do not have an attitude about most things most of the time. We tend, unless we're very strange, to really only be thinking of one thing and many things we don't care about. The connection in the book to all of this is how it's possible as you drag a society apart, as you allow people at the top to become richer, and you allow the average wages to fall, and you are willing to be very, very nasty to people on benefits, it's possible for people to become more self-absorbed with their little world and where they are, to see those above them moving away, to feel that they're not getting enough, but those beneath them are just, they don't deserve more because they don't work as hard as me. And that's the kind of danger I think you get. Another kind of problem that in a society that's becoming more unequal. If you have very good eyesight, I'm getting up to the end of my half hour now, so I will stop. You can see the reference here to the paper in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in the US of research which has just come out showing that upper class individuals are more likely to engage in unethical behaviour in laboratory tests. And the greater you increase inequalities between people, the more likely they are to do this. And it's dangerous if you have people engaging in immoral behaviour, such as voting through a bill that's going to profit you personally if you privatise the health service. The experiment they did in Peanuts, they did five experiments, but the one I like the best is they left a jar of candy, this is done in the States, they left a jar of candy in the room with people and told them the candy was for children. And they measured their social status. And then after they'd left them in the room, they then measured how much they'd stolen of the candy. So we even have connections between stealing sweets from children. We're getting lots, there's lots of exciting university research out there, as well as lots of more tedious work. But my point of this is, I think when you're trying to link inequalities in income and wealth and inequalities in health, one of the fundamental problems is that society works less efficiently when you let the richest 1% get almost about a fifth of all income, as we're heading towards now. When you get them down to having just 10 times the average, those are the countries where things tend to work much better, where their health is better, where people live longer on average. It'll be connected to what people eat and all other kinds of things, but it is harder to do well. It's more inefficient to live in a country where a few people are getting richer. And it's almost an indication that you're not organising yourself very well if you allow that to happen. Here's an example of not organising yourself well. These are the desperate emails sent out by an operator working for Harmony, that private healthcare company whose name I don't want to learn, desperately trying to get one of their pools of general practitioners to be willing to work that night to answer calls from people. And upping the wage they were willing to offer in a market system to try to get somebody, I think this was in Cornwall, west of Bodmin, to try to get somebody willing to work that night. This is the kind of stupidity you get to if you think that market systems are great. You end up with somebody desperately saying, well, what do I have to pay you to work to be a doctor? Completely forgetting the Hippocratic Oath and all the rest of it. One last graph for you. Just because this graph is new and you're very likely to have seen it, even if you like these graphs, this is wealth inequality again on the bottom, but infant mortality along the side. There is just this nice lining up that is nice when the other lining's up. And it may be that the argument about income inequality being really bad, which is made by the book The Spirit Level, is of course, the correlates work very well. But it might actually be that wealth is more important than income. And income inequality is simply reflecting wealth inequalities. My last slide. Let me check my notes so I don't miss out. Things I think we need to do. We need to get profit out of healthcare. Whenever profit's involved in healthcare, things go wrong. Healthcare is one of the obvious things where you do not want the market in it. There are things where you obviously want the market in. My favourite is always socks for some reason. Well, I really don't think the state should worry about our clothing. And there are things you don't want the market in, of which healthcare is the most obvious. I think it is tricky to find out the line in between, but I do not understand for the life of me why anybody thinks that a privatised healthcare system will be a better healthcare system, even for the rich. If you are, say, David Cameron and Sam Cam out on holiday in Cornwall, west of Bodmin, and your newborn baby has a problem a few weeks after birth, there is only the National Health Service to deal with you. There is no private A&E. There is, you know, private healthcare doesn't work for those kind of situations. It doesn't exist. So even for the rich, the market in health is bad. Also, if you're into private healthcare, if you really want Bupa to go through everything that could possibly be wrong with you, I wouldn't do it. Not on principle, just I do not want to know anything that's wrong with me. The older I get, the more sure I am about that. We need to reduce primary inequality. We need to have fewer people who are earning so little and fewer people who are earning so much. We did this before in the 1920s and 30s. It's not about taxing a lot and then giving out a lot of benefits. Countries work best when people have the money themselves at the very beginning. You need to work out how you get there. And lastly, this all fits with the kind of fund of unaccompanied by lightning and what we can do about it. It's a similar guesses, I think, to 150 years ago with cholera. Back then, people worried about things like the smell. If you could just get rid of the smell of sewage, but some other sewage, surely you'd be okay. And I think it's similar with wealth. The Conservative Party argued that if we could just get people not to notice that some people were richer than them, we'd be okay. I think we really do need to reduce wealth inequalities. If you want one policy to reduce wealth inequalities, that would not be hard to implement, that would hopefully be in favour of almost the vast majority of people. Whoever invented the banding system on council taxes was a genius. You know, band A, band B, band C, ending up around band E and F. Wales has added the band. Because they've left all the letters going up to Z. And you could simply double council tax bands all the way. You only get to M. There is no property at the moment that sells for more than about 60 million in the country. But we could extend council tax banding and have a proper land and wealth tax that didn't have a threshold of 2 million where you worried about the poor person in the £2 million home. Because you'd know that the person in the 5 million home was going to be taxed more than them, so they wouldn't feel so bad. But the 5 million pound homeowner wouldn't feel bad because the 10 million pound homeowner. See? If you want a single policy, maize is a lot of money as well, which I think we could do with at the moment and would be useful. So thanks ever so much for listening to me waffling on about unequal health, health inequalities and wealth inequalities. And please tell me where you think I'm going wrong or right. Thank you so much.
So thank you very much indeed, Danny. I'm sure that there will be questions and indeed just contributions. So we've got time to open it up now to you all. When you raise your hand, before you start to speak, if you could just wait until one of the roving mics comes to you and then speak into the mic, that will make sure that we can all hear you. So I've got a question from the man just there first, and then I'll take one from the lady on the front row.
No, I'll check there from this old people's forum. A lot of the cuts and changes that have taken place are justified by this mantra that the government keep on saying, and even the media talking about it, is that we're all living longer. Well, that might have been the case up until now, but with the extent of the cuts, with extreme weather events, and with the continuing rise in gas and electricity, leaving many pensioners, you know, without heating. Is this likely to be the case into the future? My contention is that we're not going to see people living longer than this generation into the future. Another thing I'd really like to make is that I was in Mexico a few weeks ago, and the climate, the weather, the sun, made a tremendous difference to health outcomes for sure in that country. In fact, I think they're probably almost as good as in the UK now. Whereas in Northern Europe, and in the north of England, places like Birkenhead, Teesside, Roseborough, with intense poverty, and a lack of vitamin D, surely that affects health outcomes as well. So I'd like to tackle those issue points.
Right, lots. The only area we get kind of life expectancy going down for is poor parts of Glasgow, and only then when you lump them all together. But it has happened under New Labour, that began to happen. People are looking out and expect drops in life expectancy, and the latest numbers about drops in the elderly suggest that they'd be happening. However, the poorest parts of Britain, the spearhead areas, which are the areas that the government targeted, Labour government targeted to try to make better, have had a rapid improvement since the coalition came in. And that may be because people haven't been able to leave those areas because the housing market is, so people who were doing well in those areas were getting able to buy market out there. But I would expect those poorer, older people to actually begin to see some drops given what's currently happening. And partly, drops driven by people's state of mind about how depressing it is. The opposite occurred in 1945, 46, 47, when mortality rates amongst pensioners dropped dramatically, particularly suicide amongst pensioners dropped dramatically, because pensions were coming in, and people knew where health services were going to come in. It happened before. So when you give people hope, you give them something decent, they actually live longer without actually needing any intervention. If you give people the sense that they are not valued and nobody's going to care what happens to them, you can start to begin to see mortality drop even before the meals and wheels don't turn up. Or people get scared about having to move their care home, even when it doesn't occur. There's lots of work about
life, you know, the deaths from all sorts of different things has gone compared with the rest of the country. And I'm interested to know what you think the implications are for Scotland becoming an independent country. Bearing in mind that in the spirit level they said that actually it's not the absolute wealth of the country that matters, but the health and inequalities within it. If it was its own country and inequality was less within the country, would that be a benefit? Or will it be a massive healthcare burden for the country to cope with it all on their own?
Okay. I should say, when she was very sure, but she did most of the work on the book. Okay, George did a little bit. And Bethan Thomas, who I didn't mention, you did. It's always unequal that I can do it yet, but I'll put myself in a hole before that. The Scottish figures were dramatically then. They were partly higher because Scotland gets its death records through the fast enough. For England and Wales, we weren't including people where the Commons Court hadn't met in 18 months. Those deaths never get into the computerised records. So I should say, and it's a scandal still that England and Wales doesn't do this. So we don't know. There's big increases in drug deaths in Britain. We won't know it all if it hasn't gone through the Commons Court fast enough. Alex Salmond's vision, especially Denmark is a country he uses, which is interesting given what we're beginning to learn more about Denmark. He imagines this kind of happy Scandinavian Scotland where all will get on well and share well. I think the key political issue for Scotland, because that's why I seem to be on this, didn't say no, even though I don't know enough about it at all. I think Scotland's been held together a hell of a lot by dislike of what England's done to it, by lightly. And if you were to take away that force that holds Scotland together, and you look, you'll find an incredibly unequal country. Because its life expectancy is only about a year under the English one, which means that there are some areas of incredibly good health in Scotland, as well as some very poor areas, and very different political attitudes that have been hidden because the Conservative vote has dropped and dropped and dropped. And those areas are still pretty rich. So my view is, if I was in Scotland, I'd vote for independence, but I wouldn't expect the future to necessarily be rosy. I think there'd be much more division. And the other big question for Scotland, if it's with Norway, being how can Norway try to do such a good job, is the oil. The oil's going to carry on going up in value. It almost doesn't matter that over half of it's been taken out, because the value of what's left is greater than the value of everything that's been taken out. And for Scotland, stopping the English drawing the border as a diagonal line going for the oil fields would be quite crucial to whether Scotland would do well as an independent country or not.
Other questions? Yes. Up to three quarters of the way back, yes.
Good makeup question. Why Denmark?
Why Denmark? It's Denmark and Singapore are these two places that stand out on these graphs. I don't think I've got Singapore isn't on these ones because it's too small. Singapore's fascinating. There's Singapore again. Singapore's fascinating because it has the lowest infant mortality rate in the world. And the reason it has the lowest infant mortality rate in the world, which it doesn't shout about, I've got two chapters in this book, which mean I probably can never go to Singapore again. Singapore deports pregnant servants. Almost all servants are female, 1 in 5 in the middle class has one. Your pregnancy tested, it used to be every 6 months, it's now every 3 months, and you're deported if pregnant. It's not just the deportations, it's you get a lot more abortions than the poor and all these things in Singapore, which is why Singapore, that's one extreme. Denmark is just interesting because it's not on this line. I mean, admittedly, it's not much of a line. Once you forget about Argentina, you can see why academics are arguing endlessly about how important is inequality really. Now, if Denmark wasn't here, but was up here, it'll be a lot neater. But Denmark, more possibilities, is partly here because although recently, income is recent, it's about what you cost in the last year without flow. Although recently, Denmark has become a much more equal country in terms of income. In behind that are these wealth inequalities between families in Denmark that explain more about that country than we knew from a point of view of data explains to me. Have any of you been Christiania in Copenhagen? There's a lovely slogan, which you go into Christiania, which says, save us from the Danes. And I've always wanted to measure English, trying to go, what do you mean? The Danes are lovely. So now I know about the welfare policies, because in Denmark, perhaps, it's a bit more. But that may not. There are other reasons why Danish people may smoke more. But the one thing we're fairly sure of, if you smoke more, you're going to die earlier. And you want people to smoke less, but the question is why? Why do some people smoke more? And if you live in a country where it's easier not to smoke, what is that? What can you do about it to get to that point?
Their real priorities in life are
Job working in Poundland,
back of the queue for an operation. You know, that kind of thing. Where, and it's the ways in which you talk about that. You talk about prioritising those who've worked hard in science all the life and giving them a little bit of a bonus and your call is answered within 5 minutes or something. Or you get to see a doctor within a day rather than 2 days. If you're in my scenario, it's that kind of differentiation about your customer base that you can have. The kind of nightmares are when things go wrong. So when things go bankrupt and the extent to which they're taking over or not taking over. The way you deal with bankruptcies in the private sector with this is you have mergers. So nothing is ever officially shut. If a university goes bankrupt, it won't shut. You can merge with a neighbouring university. And they won't be shut, it's just those particular buildings will be closed. So it's that kind of thing you've got to account for. And if you head towards the American system, you end up with a healthcare system which costs you twice as much, which actually delivers worse health on average for all. But this isn't, the people who are putting this into practice really believe that that isn't what's going to occur. They think they put safeguards in to stop it. And they think doctors have been lazy working for the NHS because they haven't had the incentive of money to make them work harder. But they might even think if you give people enough money, they'll move in certain areas. I don't know. It's be interesting to ask them. The other bigger problem, maybe, is going to be lack of money. Not because of the privatisation, but simply the country has got poorer. Talking to a friend earlier, another friend was saying about how in Ireland civil servants had a pay cut of 20% when Ireland was dealing with the banking crisis first of all. But the equivalent actually happened over 7 years in Britain. And that's before you even take into account that the pound's now worth 20% less, so you're poorer. The country as a whole has got a lot poorer, could be about to become a lot poorer still. There's no reason why people should have much faith in our banks again. And then we have a general talk about how do you deal with things. To give you an optimistic sense on that, we've been here before. The last time we were worse bankrupt than this was in the Second World War. And what happens when you're in a worse financial position then is that the middle class cannot afford a private doctor anymore. And so it's in the interest of the middle class to have a national health service, which is what they partly wanted and what they got in 1948. So if things are very, very bad, if things become worse, you could see something coming out of this that potentially would help save you. Whereas you could imagine the alternative. As a country does brilliantly economics, for some reason the banks do really well, money flows into London, it's the same place, the GDP goes up, the mean salary rises, if not the median salary rises. And it looks as if the country is booming, a bit like Singapore. But lots and lots of people, they've no longer got the healthcare that their parents got anymore. So it's possible to have an economic boom and a worse standard of living. And it's also possible to have the other way around and have what looks like a slump. But for most people to be better, the people at the top are not being aware.
Thank you very much. I'm going to draw it to a close there because we have come to the end of our allotted time. Before I ask you to join me in thanking Dan, I would just remind you that there are books available for sale in the bookshop here. And we'll be going with me up there to sign them immediately afterwards. So if you'd like to purchase a copy of Unlocking an Equal Health, please do make your way to the bookshop. The bar is open. Please do visit the Festival of Ideas website to find out other events that are